Hi, welcome to Cover to Cover. I'm Mark DeWitt. Today we're going to talk about Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of the Little Bighorn with Nathaniel Philbrick. Now, he's got a brand new book. It's called The Last Stand. Nathaniel, welcome.
It's great to be here.
All right, also the New York Times bestselling author of Mayflower and In the Heart of the Sea and a lot of other books. But first, let's talk about The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of the Little Bighorn. How did you come up with the idea to write about all this history?
Yeah, well, my last book was Mayflower, which is, you know, the iconic story of the beginning of America. And in my telling, it begins with the voyage of the Mayflower, but ends 50 years later with a cataclysmic native English conflict known as King Philip's War. And I said, okay, now this is the iconic beginning. Where does it lead? It leads to the Battle of Little Bighorn. You know, what began with the Pilgrims worked its way west with as America fulfilled what it viewed as manifest destiny. And I think that iconic battle is sort of the ultimate story when it comes to how we became America. And there's all sorts of legacies that I wanted to explore. And, you know, they call it Custer's last stand. Well, I thought it was also the last stand for the Lakota and Cheyenne, because Sitting Bull and his people won that war, but within just a few years, they were all on the reservations. The buffalo were no more, and it was the last stand of their traditional way of life.
This is a massive book, The Last Stand, full of history, looking at not only Custer, Sitting Bull, and the not only the Battle of the Little Bighorn, but other history of that time. How long did this book take?
Yeah, well, it took me 4 years, which is a year longer than it usually does, because I wanted to spend as much time as possible out there. I found that seeing, not only going to the battlefield, which is one of the most hauntingly spiritual places I've ever been, investigating the topography that was so important to determining the outcome, but also going to where Sitting Bull ended up, the Standing Rock Sioux Agency. Two visits there. I made it down to Pine Ridge and Wounded Knee, because this is a story that begins with the battle but really ends with Wounded Knee, because I think that's where it ultimately ended, that tragic aftermath. And so I did a lot of going to the places. And, you know, back with Mayflower, if I'd go to a historic site, there'd be a Dunkin' Donuts across the street, you know, and it wasn't just, didn't feel like it had been there. But out there, the population is still so low that you're seeing in some instances what Custer and Sitting Bull saw 134 years ago in 1876.
In the prologue of The Last Stand, you talk about Custer. That's the first pretty much scene that we see in the rolling hills in Kansas. And Custer sees a buffalo. He's chasing this buffalo, the first one he's ever seen. He gets into a little bit of a trouble there with this buffalo and his horse. He almost sounded kind of klutzy, was he?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. We remember Custer today as history's biggest loser because of the Battle of Little Bighorn. But the fact of the matter is, in the Civil War, he was one of the Union's greatest cavalry officers. You know, he was a good fighting man, but he was also an egotist. And he loved to get himself into trouble. You know, he was one of these overactive guys with a big ego. And every time he got into trouble, what he called Custer luck would save the day. And so what I found very interesting about this anecdote with which I begin the book is that, and this is from Custer's own account of his experiences in the plains of Kansas when he was new to the West. You know, he's out there chasing the Cheyenne, who are making a mockery of his attempts to pursue them. He doesn't know much about this landscape at all, and he was very flamboyant. Some have called him the cavalier in buckskin, you know, and he had a pack of English greyhounds, and the greyhounds start pursuing some antelope. And he says, I got to go chase after them. So he leaves his regiment, goes in, you know, soon swallowed up in the plains of Kansas. And they're not flat as a billiard table. They're rolling and very deceptive terrain. And soon he's entirely lost with his dogs and the antelope when he sees the buffalo. And he's going to see hundreds of thousands of these creatures in the years to come. But this is his first, and it's the biggest he'll ever see. And so he starts chasing after this buffalo. And he's just loving it. It's reminding him of his glory days during the Civil War. And he plunges his pistol into the fur of this buffalo. And then he says, no, I don't want to kill it yet. This is too much fun. So he just keeps charging along. Finally says, okay, time to kill the buffalo. So he sticks his pistol in. But before he can fire, the buffalo swerves into his horse. Custer grabs the reins, and as he grabs the reins, he pulls the trigger of the pistol, hits the horse in the head with a bullet, kills the horse instantly. Custer has time to undo his feet from the stirrups before he tumbles onto the ground, and there is the bull staring him in the face. The bull looks at Custer and stalks off, and Custer goes, holy moly, and then begins the long, slow walk back to his regiment. And I thought, this is a wonderful metaphor for what will happen to Custer at the Battle of Little Bighorn.
So it sounds like Custer might not have been the type of general that you would have wanted to serve under during the Civil War.
Right. Well, he had a reputation for, you know, victories, but he also had a reputation for losing a lot of men in the process. He had something like 11 horses shot out from underneath him during the Civil War. He was absolutely reckless when it came to his own bravery. General Sheridan would say to him after he married the love of his life, Libby, "You are the only officer for whom marriage has not ruined for a charge." He had never had any sense of, you know, fear at all. And so if you were a soldier with Custer, you had reason to pause.
Nathaniel, the book The Last Stand, you did a lot of research going to around Montana where the battle took place. You went to the reservation in South Dakota where the Lakota Sioux are today.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost like a third world country. Tell me about Pine Ridge and the surrounding areas.
Yeah, well, I went to Pine Ridge and the Standing Rock Sioux Agency, which is about 200 miles to the north on the Missouri. And, you know, it was very sobering because, you know, we think of the West as, you know, that iconic thing from the past, but the legacy of the West continues on in these reservations. It's not an easy life at all. Terrible disease, you know, suicide, alcoholism. And, you know, this is the legacy of Manifest Destiny that America, the American government, has not really faced up to yet. And I think it's a tragedy, and I think it's means that the story of the Little Bighorn and what happened out West is one we are still living with today.
The residents of Pine Ridge and the reservation, what are their feelings on the government today, and maybe even the government from years gone by?
Well, you know, this is the battle is it lives on. And imagine, I talked to Ernie LaPointe, who is the great grandson of Sitting Bull, and actually he's quoted in my epilogue. And, you know, I asked him, what does the battle mean to you? Well, and he said, you know, we took their flag at that battle. And we had a great victory. And people describe us as a defeated people, but they never defeated us. You don't, you know, what happened at Wounded Knee, where you kill women and children? Killing off the buffalo, stealing our land, does not constitute victory. And, you know, so we still have their flag, and that gives us some strength. But the fact of the matter is, you know, what has happened in so many instances out West in South Dakota and other places is criminal, and but it's, you know, that's why stories from the past are an important part of America coming to terms with who we are as a nation.
Custer, quite the figure in television and books. I know when you were growing up, you would watch Custer's Last Stand on the television. After doing the research on Custer and the events, how different is Custer actually than what they portray on television?
Oh, you know, I just was fascinated with the complexity of the man. Yeah, I saw Custer in Little Big Man, you know, where the wild-eyed warmonger, and he goes basically nuts in the middle of the battle. And that fascinated me with the topic. But Custer that was an element in his personality, definitely. We've, you know, talked about his almost reckless bravery. But he was very well read, a great writer. He wrote a book, My Life on the Plains, a great self-promoter, very savvy with the media. Other officers really resented that because, you know, he would play it perfectly to the reporters. His wife, Libby, was probably the greatest spin doctor an officer could ever be married to. So she helped, you know, keep that myth going even after Custer's death. But, you know, his best friend in life was a Shakespearean actor named Lawrence Barrett. I mean, you know, he was, we think of him as striding through history, doing exactly what he wanted. But the fact of the matter is, in 1876, he was in trouble with President Grant. Politically, he had testified before Congress in a committee looking into corruption in the Grant administration and fingered Grant's brother, Orville. The presidents always seem to have a younger brother that gets them into trouble. And this infuriated Grant. And so he stripped Custer of command of this campaign. The hue and cry from the public meant that Custer was reinstated, but not as commander. Another general, General Terry, was put in command. So Custer had a big chip on his shoulder going into this. You know, we think of him with the long flowing locks, and Custer was 36 in 1873, beginning to go bald, and like many of us follically challenged guys, shaved his head prior to heading out from Fort Lincoln. And so he didn't look anything like the icon. And in fact, in the battle, the Lakota and Cheyenne didn't recognize him. It wasn't until afterwards that they figured out who they had been fighting. And so I began to see Custer, you know, as a man, and yeah, he was an egomaniac, self-promoter, but he had his frailties. He also had there were times during his campaigns out in Kansas against the Cheyenne where, yes, he did attack one village famously, the Battle of the Washita, but in another instance, he said, wait a minute, let's see if we can talk to them. He had a past of negotiation, and so there are all sorts of sides to him, and I think ultimately this book is a tragedy because, you know, Custer fulfilled his destiny, but it could have gone completely another way.
If you're just tuning in, this is Cover to Cover. I'm Mark DeWitt. We're talking with Nathaniel Philbrick, author of his brand new book, The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of the Little Bighorn. Also the author of The Mayflower and In the Heart of the Sea. Now let's talk about some of your other books, if we could switch gears here just a little bit. We touched on The Mayflower a little bit. Talk to me a little about The Mayflower. When did the book start and when did it end and what period of time?
Yeah, well, in many ways, Mayflower is misnamed because it's you know, we all think the Mayflower brought over the Pilgrims, and that's where my book starts, with that voyage. But really, the book is about the settlement of Plymouth Colony and what would happen between the first generation and the third generation, a 50-year span. And in the beginning, there was remarkable cooperation between the Pilgrims and Massasoit, the Wampanoag sachem. And they created an incredibly bicultural community compared to what would happen in the future of American history. And it lasted for 50 years. This was no paradise. There was a lot of negotiation, give and take. There were even outbreaks of violence. But, you know, it stayed stable for half a century. But then with the second and third generation, you know, they didn't, the English didn't see the Indians anymore as essential to their own survival, because without the Native Americans, those early Pilgrim settlers would have died that first winter. They began to covet their land. And so what had begun as a cooperative endeavor became, just like it would over and over again in American history, result in a terrible war, King Philip's War. When you look at the percentage of people killed in King Philip's War, it was the bloodiest war fought on American soil, even more deadly than the Civil War. You know, smaller numbers, but in terms of what it felt like to live through, it was just a horrible conflict. And most Americans know nothing about it. You know, our sense of the Pilgrim stops with the Mayflower. And so with this book, I really wanted to say, yes, it starts with the voyage in 1620, but you got to also look to 1676 when this terrible battle ended, because that's the real legacy of the so-called Pilgrim Fathers.
Nathaniel, in business, it seems like that the first person that starts the business, it really goes, he passes it down to the son.
Yes.
It's still a going business. But by the time you get to about the third generation or so, it starts to fall off. After doing the research on the Mayflower, is it kind of surprising that we really lasted as the United States?
Yeah, I mean, you begin to see the volatility of things. And as you said, you know, the people who start something have a vision, have the charisma, energy to get it started. They're extraordinary people in extraordinary situations. You know, and that applies to the business world. My brother's a banker. He tells me all the time, you know, if it's a family business, look out, you know, things change. And you know, you're right. You look at our country. In one sense, we are a big family. But I think one of the things, you know, I love this country. I mean, my books tend to point out things that didn't always go right and legacies that need to be addressed, I feel. But in the end, this is the greatest country on earth, I think, in large part because we're one of the few nations that will look back to this kind of past and see and recognize the things that went wrong. And not a lot of nations do that. And, you know, the fact of the matter is our version of colonialism, of empire, involved where we live today. And so we are living with the consequences. And I think the great hope for America is that, you know, there were the founding fathers. You know, we revere them. But what I've come to realize, yeah, they were people too. And we are, every time is full of complexity, ambiguity, danger, terror. And it's up to every generation to do the best they can. And that's all we can ask of anyone.
In the Heart of the Sea, another New York Times best-selling book by Nathaniel Philbrick. This book takes place when? About the time of Moby Dick or so?
Yeah, well, it's you know, I grew up, I didn't grow up there, but I moved to Nantucket Island in my 30s. And that's where my wife and I raised our family. And I became and I was a big fan of Moby Dick. And Moby Dick, famously, the voyage of the Pequod begins on Nantucket. So for me, it was the holy ground of that novel. And the climax of Moby Dick is based on a real-life event. The whale ship Essex in 1820, November 20th of 1820, was rammed and sunk by a whale. And where Moby Dick ends with the sinking of the Pequod is the beginning of the real-life story of the Essex, because the crew took to their small 25-foot-long whaleboats and decided to go for South America, 3,000 miles away. And it would become a terrible tale of survival. They were fearful of the cannibals that they thought were on the Marquesas Islands, just a few days away to the west. So they sailed east. So they sailed east to South America. And they would be out there for more than 3 months. And the terrible irony is, as they began to starve to death, they were reduced to survival cannibalism. And 5 Nantucketers would get out of 2 whaleboats alive. 1 other whaleboat was never seen again. And so it's a story that I think has a lot to say about America. Whaling was our first global economy, and it was based on a perishable resource, whales. And, you know, and as soon as oil was discovered in the 1850s, it was the end of the whaling industry, and Nantucket's economy completely shut down. And, you know, I think it has a lot to teach us about the perils of relying on any one energy source.
So what was the life like for a whaler?
Oh, it was unimaginably dangerous. And you know, we have a hard time struggling with work and family. You know, we have a hard time if, you know, we're 8 hours away from our kids. Oh my God, what are we doing? Well, these days, a whaler would leave, for a 3 to 4 year voyage. It was common for kids as young as 12 to go out on their first voyage. Can you imagine this? Your 12-year-old kid departs on a voyage. You don't see him till he's 16. He'd come home for 3-4 months. And then go out again. And so as a consequence, Nantucket became this very female-dominated society in many ways, because women were making things. It was, you know, this was not a feminist utopia by any means, but there were a lot of strong women because they had to keep the farms and the businesses going. And, you know, it was all built around keeping this business of bloody business of whaling going. I mean, they were going out killing whales, I mean, harpooning them, cutting them into blubber, boiling the blubber down into oil, putting it in barrels, and then doing it 40, 50 times, and then finally coming back.
So they would do this out on the ship?
Out on the ship. These were floating factories, and there was just horrible smoke that would come up from these fires, black soot full of grease that would cling to your skin, and it was really. I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and it was as bad as the steel mills in the heyday of that industry, but on a ship in the middle of the Pacific.
You know, I didn't realize that. I just thought they took the whales back to the land and rendered everything there.
That's how it started, and then it quickly evolved into a very sophisticated industry. It was really an industry, and so that's what's been kind of cool for me with that book, is it sort of introduced people to the fact that, you know, before there were the factories of the industrial age, there was a floating version of this, and that, you know, and it wasn't just factory ships at sea. These guys were explorers. They were chasing, you know, they'd go to one place where there are whales, fish it out, and then have to move on. And so by the Essex in 1820, they had been forced off the west coast of South America to the offshore ground, several thousand miles from there. And then within just a few years' time, they would be forced to the Japan ground, even farther. And so, you know, to relentlessly following the whale around the world and becoming not only a whaleman, but explorers.
You know, I guess you could call that the world's first offshore oil rigs.
Yes, think about it. And, you know, what's happening now in the Gulf today is just this horrible ecological disaster. And these guys were raising ecological havoc. You know, they would often be the first white man a South Sea Islander would see. I mean, they would, and then, you know, you get these whalemen in a South Sea island, you know, what it would do to, you know, the whim. You know, it was just awful. And they'd go from island to island. Bringing American culture with all its vices, spreading it around the world. And they were decimating the whale population in the process.
Well, from the East Coast with Mayflower and pretty much on the East Coast and around the world in the heart of the sea, we find ourselves in the West, in the United States, with The Last Stand. Tell me a little bit about The Last Stand, where that was in what's now known as Montana.
Right, south central Montana. The battlefield is approximately midway between Billings, Montana to the north and Sheridan, Wyoming to the south. And if you go out there today, there's just not a lot of people. And as a consequence, it looks very much the way it did. The battlefield, The Last Stand, Custer, as he approached Sitting Bull's village, he knew it was there because they had seen the smoke rising up from it in the morning, and they could see also evidence of the huge 20,000 pony herd that was with this 8,000-person village. But they couldn't see the village. It was hidden behind the bluffs that are on the east side of the Little Bighorn River. And so it wasn't until Custer was right upon the village, he was on a bluff overlooking, that he sees, oh my gosh, this is a huge village. Prior to that, his scouts had told him that the village was beginning to disperse. And that's what every officer feared. They didn't fear the size of the village. That was not their biggest concern. It was that it would fragment before they could attack. And so Custer, in anticipation of that, had divided his regiment into three battalions. His battalion was just 210 men, but the largest of the three battalions. He had worked his way onto the bluff, and he sees this huge village, and he's not scared about it, by it. He says, hey, my gosh, I've done the impossible. I've found these warriors napping in the middle of the day. And so he's delighted, but he sends a note to his senior captain, Frederick Benteen, who's leading one of those battalions that had swung far to the left. He says, come on quick, big village, and bring ammunition. Benteen, along with Major Marcus Reno, who led the other battalion, despised Custer, hated him, and he did everything he could to delay his return. Eventually, he gets to a bluff very near where Custer had first sighted the village. By this time, Custer had moved on to the north on the other side of an intervening bluff. And there Benteen finds Reno, who had just retreated to that bluff after getting his you-know-what kicked by the Lakota warriors. And Reno saying, oh my gosh, you know, help me, help me. Benteen sees this as a wonderful excuse not to follow Custer's orders. They spend about an hour just sitting there. finally, one of their officers is so infuriated by this that he goes off on his own. This shames them into following him. But by the time they get to what's known as Weir Peak and look out towards Last Stand Hill, all they see is smoke and dust and some figures in the distance, but they don't know what it is. But then they see the warriors turning around and coming towards them. They retreat to an area for a final siege, and they don't know what happens to Custer until 2.5 days later when the siege is over and they find the 210 bodies scattered around Last Stand Hill.
Nathaniel, I know you've been to Wounded Knee. That was where the United States killed a lot of kids, women, old women.
Yep.
And actually, there's a marker there also, the burial grounds. In your own mind, I guess, when you were there, how did you feel? What did you see? How did you feel?
I mean, it was one of the most disturbing experiences. It's fun. It's like getting all the emotions you have sucked out of you. I mean, I was just thunderstruck. You know, there's something about that landscape that just gets into your soul like battery acid. And, you know, it's just one of those, and, you know, it's not a site, you know, you have to really work at it to find this place. And you get there and you realize, you know, something really awful and terrifying and heartbreaking happened here. And it's in the landscape, you know, the whole cemetery there, it's very moving, you know, and it was the scene of, you know, another tragedy, you know, much later in the 20th century. And so it's one of those landscapes that gets into your, you know, your very being. And, you know, and it was an essential part of writing this book. I had to go there.
If I want more information about The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of the Little Bighorn, if I want more information on Nathaniel Philbrick, maybe your other books such as The Mayflower and In the Heart of the Sea, plus the others, do you have a website?
Yeah, nathanielphilbrick.com, and I just redid the website, and you can email me from the website. You know, it's got all sorts of links to other. I've got a video on there about the research for The Last Stand, and you can find out about my other books as well.
Well, Nathaniel takes you back to a dangerous time in the United States history, out west, the Wild West, Kansas, the Rolling Hills, up through Wyoming, Montana, to what today is the reservation for the Lakota Sioux. Nathaniel, it was almost like being there. Thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you. I've really enjoyed this.
Take a trip with Nathaniel Philbrick and The Last Stand, with Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of the Little Bighorn. Been listening to Cover to Cover. Been your host, Mark DeWitt. Questions and concerns may be addressed to 2045 Gilbert Avenue, Cincinnati, Ohio, 45202.